Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Carolina de Robertis, whose latest novel is The Gods of Tango. Earlier novels, Perla, The Invisible Mountain, translator of two books, Bonsai by Alejandro Zambra and The Neruda Case by Roberto Ampuero. And we're going to talk a little about the translation and what it takes to be a translator of a novel. But first, let's talk about The Gods of Tango, your latest book. Briefly, it's the story of a woman, an immigrant, who comes over in 1913 from Italy to Buenos Aires. She's planning to be married, but it turns out that her fiancé has been killed in an anarchist riot. Along the way, she disguises herself as a man so that she can be a tango musician. So let's go back a little bit. I know that when you were asked about Perla, you said that the book derived from research that you did on the Invisible Mountain. So what kind of research and what was the instigator for this story in The Gods of Tango?
The initial instigator was my desire to write about the wave of immigration that came from Southern Europe, Italy, and other places as well to Argentina and Uruguay at the turn of the 20th century. My great-grandparents formed part of that wave, so I knew that there were parts of my own sort of family lore and cultural roots that I had not yet been able to mine in my first two novels.
Were they from Italy then?
Yes, they were from a tiny little town called Prepezzano of 100 people, and the town that my protagonist is from in The Gods of Tango is modeled on that town. I was able to visit it in 2010, connected with long-lost relatives on the Italian side, and began my research, actually, in Italy. And then I researched in Uruguay, Argentina, the United States extensively.
So you started with the story of immigration, and what led you to Lita/Dante? And what led you to tango?
In researching that migratory wave, I began to explore what those immigrants found when they came to Buenos Aires and very quickly realized that the pulsing cultural heart of what they found on the poor side of town in Buenos Aires was truly the tango, or embodied in the tango. The tango is a musical form, a dance form, and also a cultural phenomenon that arose out of the crowded, dirty tenements of neighborhoods that became filled with immigrants. Cuban sailors brought their rumba, this mixed in with the tango. People of African descent and their drums and their polyrhythms contributed, their syncopations contributed to what the tango became very much. And we certainly have Afro-Argentinians to thank in part for the tango. So it really rose out of this cultural cauldron that the city was at that time. And I realized, wow, this is a story that has not fully been told in Argentinian literature or anywhere else that I've seen it.
What exactly defines a tango? What exactly is the core that makes something a tango?
That is an excellent question, and it is a question that tango musicians and scholars have been asking themselves through generations, because as a musical form evolves and becomes adventurous and explores new terrains, people sometimes say, oh, this isn't classical tango, it's not really tango anymore. For example, when Astor Piazzolla in the 1950s and after began to innovate the traditional tango, bringing in jazz and classical elements, you know, it was a revolution to the tango. It was still the heart of the sound. Part of what makes it tango is the sound of the bandoneon, originally a German instrument. It's that accordion-like sound, one of the primary voices. When you hear it, you think tango. It's a very velvety wail full of longing and yearning that captures the yearning of the immigrants who, in part, gave birth to this musical form. So when Piazzolla rose up, people said, oh, that isn't really the tango anymore, you know, the purists. But the tango has always evolved, just like all musical forms.
What's curious, and I guess it came in your research, is in fact the tango existed before the bandoneon.
It absolutely did. It did. The tango began to rise probably around the 1880s, although the very beginnings of the tango, from the 1880s to about 1913 when this book opens, are extremely murky. Since it grew up in the neighborhoods of the poor, in the peripheries of Buenos Aires, among descendants of enslaved people. The elite were not paying attention. Nobody was going out there with, you know, the primitive recording devices of the time. Nobody was doing the primary research. Nobody interviewed these very early tango musicians. We have no photographs. And so it's kind of buried in the mists of time, those very, very early times. But in those times, absolutely, tango was very different. It was a more happy dance. It was very joyous and festive. The drums were a huge part of it. Portable instruments. The piano came in later when rich folks started to put the tango in fancy cabarets. Before that, it was whatever you could carry around. Violins, flutes, guitar were part of early tango. And the lyrics were very lewd and obscene.
But there were no tango singers, per se.
Carlos Gardel was a tremendous innovator of the tango canción, or tango song, which right. made the singer of the tango very central to the music. And that began to really rise up around 1917, and we see that happen in the book. Before that, the tangos did have lyrics, but they were kind of sung casually, and the instruments were front and center. What changed with the rise of the tango canción is that the tango began to tell a story, a ballad with a beginning, middle, and end, a personality, relaying, you know, his heartbreak over a lost love, for example.
So you had this area that nobody really has covered in novels, and you can kind of create who created the bandoneon, who created the first female singer. All of that can come out of the novel then, because we don't know what it is.
I absolutely had a lot of room to create in that way, yes. And I also, for me in writing historical novels, if I do find information, it is very important to me to strive to do justice to the true historical figures of those times when I can find them, and especially when they're historically marginalized people. So, for example, I absolutely invented people to fill in the void of Afro-Argentinians who contributed to the tango, but I also inserted the real names of Casimiro and Sinforoso, who were two black men who played in a duo and brought the tango around their neighborhood of San Telmo and were considered one of the first tango duos to really bring the tango as a music for dance to cafes. And these innovators have really been lost in time. They are tiny footnotes in the main scholarship of tango, even in Spanish in Argentina. And so I really wanted to give them name, give them space, give them voice.
Carolina de Robertis, so we've got the tango, and now you have to tell a story. Where does Lita come in? Why did you choose the idea of a woman coming to Argentina and disguising herself as a man?
It's one of those novelistic choices that doesn't happen consciously from an intellectual place. As I wrote, I had a female protagonist arriving on the ship. I really wanted to know what would happen to her. Our beloved Toni Morrison says that novels are inquiries. They begin with an urgent question. And one of my urgent questions was, what would the Buenos Aires of that time have been like through her eyes? Very quickly, it became obvious that she would not be able to enter the spaces where the tango was being played in public, the brothels, the CD cafes, without essentially becoming a prostitute or putting herself in danger, unless she dressed as a man.
Had it occurred to you to make her a prostitute at one point?
I explored it a little, but it didn't go very far. I knew that what I wanted for her was the journey of being able to actually enter the tango world and experience it on her own terms and kind of infiltrate what was at the time a very male-dominated world. Only men could play instruments in these tango groups. And it was a very male-dominated space. And the tango has always been associated with a very male-female kind of strict gender role. The female dances one way, she follows, the man leads. The songs of the 1920s and 30s, the tango canción we were talking about, are often filled with this very male bravado and swagger. And what would it be like for a woman to enter that space disguised as a man and kind of staking out space on her own terms? Also, as an immigration story, it's very realistic that a woman would take that step as a survival thing. I think that that is something that women have done throughout history far more than our sort of codified histories acknowledge.
So there was never a thought of going, well, maybe I should make it a man because that would be easier that way, or were you always intent on looking at the world through the role of a woman?
Very, very early on, I explored the possibility of writing a man, perhaps a gay man. There was a lot of early sketching. And in that early sketching, once it was a woman disguised as a man who discovered that she herself was attracted to women, that was the sketch that began to become larger than life and breathe and sort of draw me back constantly.
What kind of research did you do into women in the tango? Were there any women who actually disguised themselves like that, that you know of?
I don't know of any documented cases in which women successfully passed as men in that period in order to play as a tango musician. However, that may simply mean that women were successful with their disguise. I did, however, find some really interesting, fascinating and underreported phenomenon of women cross-dressing in order to take the stage in the tango world. Beginning in the 1920s, there was a woman called Azucena Maizani, who was the primary pioneer. And I found her about 2 years into writing this book. I had been researching every scholarly text on tango I could find in English and Spanish. And I finally found 2 pages on her and found this photograph of her in a fedora and a suit and lipstick. And she would get on the stage and she would sing from a male perspective these songs about, you know, how women love her and how she's going to go and she's going to conquest these women, and very much from a male bravado perspective. Women did that because at the time all the lyrics being published were from a male perspective. And so women were told, you cannot sing these songs. And so women said, well, I'll put on a suit and I'll take some space up.
And thus is born the character of Rosa.
And thus is born the character of Rosa. When I read that, I thought, well, I have to put that version of this in. Someone who's not actually trying to pass at all times, but who takes on that drag on the stage and sings. And I did create a character in my book who is inspired by that absolutely real phenomenon in tango history that I feel deserves a whole lot more space in tango history and in Argentinian history than it has yet received.
Carolina de Robertis, did you do research into the various neighborhoods of 1913? And how did you find exactly where the poor and the rich neighborhoods were and how they interacted?
I did. I did do a lot of research. I have the very good fortune of having a lot of incredibly loving uncles, aunts, and cousins in Buenos Aires. I primarily identify as Uruguayan, but I also have Argentinian grandparents on one side, and from that side of the family, I have a lot of family there. I stayed with them. I did a great deal of research. People wandered with me a great deal. I mean, you know, when I was 16, my uncle took me to the little fishing bar where he, you know, took my father to teach him how to drink when he was a teenager. So I've known these neighborhoods, La Boca and San Telmo, for a long time. And also have known the other side, Palermo, La Recoleta. That's the wealthier side of town. So when I was consciously researching this book, I wandered a lot. San Telmo is a neighborhood that is famous for having a lot of little antique shops. And poking around in those antique shops is one example of doing a more sensuous and tactile form of research, just looking at all the brooches and little spoons and postcards and tables and all the items that were part of the lives of the people who were contemporary to my characters.
Where did you discover the story of the conventillo? Is that the correct pronunciation?
It is, if you speak Spanish that is not Argentinian.
Okay. So how would you pronounce
we
it?
We say conventillo, but that's because we speak a little funny.
Okay. In your research, how did you discover the conventillo, which are basically communal living spaces where multiple families live together, poor families?
Yeah, the conventillos are sort of like tenements, except when we think of the tenements in New York that used to be immigrant, you can go and tour them these days, and it's little apartments where families lived on their own. They had their own kitchen and so forth. Conventillos, on the other hand, are, you know, families to a room or 8 bachelors piled up together in a room, you know, not a lot of air circulating and sharing a kitchen, sharing 1, maybe 2 toilets. These were very dirty, cramped conditions. And yet it also built a kind of community among these immigrants who were really showing up for each other and interweaving lives, often across cultures and languages because they came from different places. There are places in La Boca and San Telmo where you can go and see buildings that used to be conventillos.
You mean like museum type thing?
Yeah, there isn't so much a sort of a museum of the conventillo. But if you know what a conventillo was, you can walk and you can see, for example, the antique shops of San Telmo that I mentioned. Some of these antique shops are all down a hall. They're in little rooms, and those rooms are where the families used to live. I was lucky to go on historical tours with trained historians of these places, and they showed me exactly where places were and how you could tell that families used to live there.
Had you heard of them before?
I had. It was a part of the history of Argentina that I became familiar with very early on. I mean, from the first time I went back to visit my relatives in Argentina and Uruguay at the age of 16, I was incredibly curious about history and roots and all those things before I was conscious of wanting to write a novel about these things.
What for you was the relationship of the truth of your story and history? Where did you have to kind of go, well, that's history, but it doesn't quite work? Or did you always manage to stay within history?
The places where something really collides with a major historical event, whether cultural or political, I have really tried to stay true to them. So, for example, the night that Carlos Gardel debuts the song Mi Noche Triste and kind of shifts the way the tango canción is perceived, I made that the same exact date of the same exact year. Again, I feel that it's very important to honor the history. And I also think it's important because even though novels are works of fiction, they can be windows into a culture, windows into a world and a time and place. I know that for me as a reader, one of the things I love about novels is their capacity to transport me so that I feel that I've been in 1980s Warsaw or whatever the setting may be. And so I want to do my very best due diligence to offer that to readers. Where I might have taken some flights is where I needed to fill in or I needed to make things work for the story. For example, that night of the singing of Mi Noche Triste, I made up the headlines that happened in the following days. I made them up making my best conjecture based on my research, but certainly a scholarly historian couldn't get away with that.
Before we move on to your career, a couple of questions. Toward the end of the book, Dante, Lita becoming Dante, realizes that she's a lesbian, even though there doesn't seem to be a term for it at the time. Did you do any research into lesbian and gay life in Buenos Aires back in the first half of the 20th century? Was anything available?
I tried. I tried to research gay and lesbian history in, you know, early 20th century Buenos Aires. The truth is that there really isn't any documentation. There is conjecture. There are suggestions. The singer Azucena Maizani, when you look at the scope of her life and how she never married and some of her interests, you know, one can guess that perhaps she had other feelings. They may have gone fully expressed or not. She may have been bisexual. We'll just never know. There are queer scholars in the United States who like to say that gay male culture is part of the early tango because men used to dance tango together. But the truth is that men danced tango together with each other because there were not enough prostitutes and they were waiting in line at the brothel. And this was something that they could do with each other to pass the time and also to practice and become better dancers in case they ever found a decent girl to court. So it was part of accepted heterosexual masculinity for them to dance the tango together. So I think that it's certainly optimistic of queer historians to say this is part of that history. And certainly, I'm sure there were men who were very aroused by this experience. However, it's not, you know, sort of an out gay phenomenon. Just like the early music of the tango, this was something that was not paid attention to. And so sadly, we have lost a tremendous amount of information about what really happened.
Well, you're talking about 100 years ago and you're talking about a Catholic country where I guess if you really want to be gay, you become a priest if you're a man.
Perhaps. Now Argentina has become the first Latin American country to legalize gay marriage in 2010, so maybe there are more options.
Carolina de Robertis, after reading Gods of Tango, I kept thinking, you know, I need to go to Buenos Aires.
I hope you do. I hope you do. It is really a very gorgeous city. People call it the Paris of South America for a reason.
One final question, and it's weird. It happened the same time I was reading something online, and I came across a reference to the Paraguay War the next day, I think I'm reading part of Gods of Tango, and I came across a reference to the Paraguay War. For some reason, I didn't know about it. This occurred in the mid-1800s, and hundreds of thousands of people were killed?
Yes, and what's incredible is, of course, in the United States, nobody's heard of the War of Paraguay, or as it's sometimes called, the War of the Triple Alliance. That's what people call it in Paraguay. But this was a war in the 1860s in which three countries, Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina, ganged up and invaded Paraguay and really destroyed the country in a manner that it hasn't recovered since. In fact, I was just speaking to a Uruguayan friend who went and researched in Paraguay and spoke to people about the war. And first of all, there's still a tremendous silence about it, lots of trauma. And he said, when you speak to people in Paraguay about the Paraguayan War, it's as if it happened yesterday. One of my closest friends in Uruguay is actually a Paraguayan emigre, and she also talks about how absolutely formative it was, almost like the Civil War in some parts of the South. It's a war that is still very much alive in the Paraguayan imagination and also in the region. People are still very much affected. It's quite devastating. In the case of Argentina and Uruguay, those two nations had much more significant black populations before that war. And one of the things that occurred is that the government promised freedom to people in exchange for basically being drafted. And a lot of Afro-Argentinians and Afro-Uruguayans went to those killing fields as cannon fodder. So I wove that into this book about the origins of the tango, because the communities, the black communities of Buenos Aires, would have still been traumatized by the loss of so many men of their prior generation.
Carolina de Robertus, on Facebook, somebody posted a GIF of slave ships coming from Africa to America, and you look at it and you realize that the majority of slave ships went to Brazil and to Argentina. You're apparently producing or working on a documentary about it at this particular time called Afro-Uruguay?
That's right. So my wife, Pamela Harris, is a documentary filmmaker, and she received a Fulbright Fellowship to make this film, Afro-Uruguay, about black people in Uruguay. She's the producer-director, and she happily pulled me in as co-producer. We moved to Uruguay at the end of 2012 with our two small children and our gay family, and it went great, actually. Gay marriage was legalized in the time that we were living there, which is a pretty incredible experience to have. The United States has now caught up to Uruguay. So we worked on this film for a year and a half, gathering stories and interviewing people. And in the end, we followed one particular woman, her journey as a black activist, and also the turmoil in her relationship with her historically black neighborhood, which has had so many different phases of resilience and struggle. It was pretty incredible to be entrusted with so many stories by Afro-Uruguayans who maybe had not had the opportunity, but also have not maybe built the trust in order to really fully sort of open the shoebox of historic photographs that they have, which are not available at the National Library. They're only in the shoeboxes of people's homes. We've come back with an incredible wealth of material.
The story of Perla, your second novel, deals with the disappeared and the relationship afterward. As you're doing this later research on the Paraguayan War and on the African relationship to South America, is there any relationship to that, to these incredibly violent military dictatorships of Argentina or Chile, or is that sort of just a byproduct of colonialism?
I certainly think that in order to create a truly robust, secure, and thriving democracy, it is essential to look in the eye all of the atrocities and injustices that have occurred within your nation. Even when they're far back, they still continue to affect the present day. As we can see in the United States from the legacy of slavery, it was not that long ago that we had slavery in this country. It was only a few generations ago. So the ripple effects are still here. We can absolutely make that parallel in Argentina and Uruguay. I think that, for example, in the case of Argentina, the nation has done an incredibly good job of documenting the stories of the few who survived the concentration camps where the desaparecidos or disappeared were. A year after democracy returned in the 80s, a commission was created to gather stories and created a book called Nunca Más that gathered those stories. There's been a huge amount of restitution and justice and all of these things. And the same thing has not happened for the injustices that occurred towards Afro-Argentinians. And the same thing has certainly not happened for the genocide of indigenous people who were, in fact, there before any Europeans or Africans arrived on the land that is now Argentina. I think Argentina still has quite a way to go to reconcile that. And I absolutely do think that for the progressive left in Argentina, it's going to have to be part of their journey at some point in order to really bring democracy fully to center. Otherwise, you're building castles on sand.
Carolina de Robertis, let's go back and talk a little about your career. In an interview, I found out that your first story was written, a science fiction story, at the age of 7.
Oh, Spimp the Little Kirmi is the title of that story. I have it somewhere.
Somewhere along the line, you wound up becoming a novelist and getting published. Fill us in a little bit on that. Did you continue writing? What was your first sale and so on?
Spimp the Little Kirmi, my story from the age of 7, was never published. From the age of 7 on, let's see, when I was 10, we moved to the United States from Switzerland. We were sort of immigrants in various countries, and then we made our way to the United States, and one of the things that happened was I had access to this enormous English language public library, or it looked enormous to me, and I started to sort of inhale all these books, and I grew up with my nose in a book. I mean, that's really looking back what made me a writer.
Where was that?
In Southern California, in Los Angeles.
What brought your parents to this country?
My father's job. He's an academic. So he got a job at UCLA because my mother was suffering very deeply living in xenophobic Switzerland. And so we ended up making a move.
Did you know English at the time you came over?
I did. I was actually born in England. I first immigrated when I was in my mother's womb. I was made in Uruguay. The day I was born, I was already an immigrant. So I had English and Spanish from the get-go. Both languages were always with me. I really see them as my two mother tongues. It's like I've got two mommies, linguistically speaking.
You come to the States and you start reading a lot. At what point do you start thinking about writing?
I've always been incredibly passionate about books, reading, writing. Since that time when I was 10, I knew that there was absolutely nothing I would rather do with my life than be a writer, but that didn't mean that I really had the self-confidence to actually do it. When I was in college, I applied to the creative writing classes at my university, and I didn't get in. And that was crushing for a while. You know, I just sort of kept on going with building a life. I thought, well, if I can't be a writer, what else can I do? I'd like to do something to make the world a better place. So I graduated and became first an inner city school teacher in San Francisco. Inner city is such a strange term, but in any case, a school teacher.
In San Francisco in particular.
In Hunters Point.
Oh, okay.
And then I became a rape crisis counselor at Bay Area Women Against Rape, which is our East Bay Alameda County Rape Crisis Center. Looking back, I really do see that as another training ground for me in becoming a writer because I had the immense privilege and honor of bearing witness to people's stories. I listened to over 1,000 rape survivors and their significant others as they shared some of the most horrific and intimate experiences of their lives. And not only was exposed to the trauma that can occur in a human life, but also to the immense resilience of the human soul. And those people, while I was there for them and for their healing, they also gave me more gifts than I could have found in 100 libraries.
So what got you started on Invisible Mountain? Were there short stories before then, or was that just kind of, hey, I'm going to finally sit down and do it?
I didn't start with short stories. I really am glad I didn't encounter quite enough people to discourage me with starting with a novel, because I know that there are people in MFA programs who do just that and in other
right.
teaching situations. So as an MFA teacher now, I'm very adamant about write what you've got to write, you know, do your thing, because I have written a few short stories and I respect and adore the short story, certainly as a reader. But I'm a novelist. It's what I do. I make big worlds. That's my work. So I started with the novel when I was 25 in absolute secret.
And so you're writing this generational saga
I had
about
to write
South America.
Yeah, that's what I had to write. It was the thing that would keep me obsessed. It was the thing that was most urgent.
Did you just send it out to an agent? How did it get published?
5 years into writing the book, I sent out query letters because I mistakenly thought that my manuscript was ready. And I was very lucky that an agent, a wonderful agent, wrote back and said, I want to represent you and your book still needs work. She signed me on and put me back to work. I worked on the book for 3 more years, actually, and she stuck with me through several revisions. So the book took 8 years altogether. I'm so grateful that she was blunt with me at the time. It was hard to hear, but it was true. I was not yet able to determine the readiness of my own work. I didn't have those skills at the time.
And then after that, the research on that led you to Perla.
Yes. And then after that, there was so much. You know, I wanted to write this big, enormous novel that could attempt to hold Uruguayan history. And, of course, it's impossible to hold an entire nation in one book. So there's all these pieces that end up on the editing floor. The book is 3 generations, but the original draft was 4 generations, including my generation, people who were born in the 1970s during the time of the dictatorship in Uruguay and Argentina. And my agent rightly said that this wasn't fitting and quite working. And so I had to chop off the last 60 pages of the book and make a new ending. It was great for the book, but I was left feeling like I haven't told this story yet about what happens to the people who grow up during and after and with the legacies of these dictatorships. So that became Perla.
Carolina de Robertis, we still haven't gotten to your 2 translations. How did you become a translator? I know it's very difficult to be a translator. It's probably easier because from what I've seen, Spanish translates very nicely into English.
I'm glad you think so. They're not such distant cousins. You know, they have similar Indo-European roots. And so that helps, I think. There are cognates and so forth, although there are also false cognates and traps that you need to be wary of as well.
What I discovered when I was taking Spanish in school is that when we had to translate Lorca, let's say, mm-hmm. you know, it always came out sounding like poetry. It sounded good. It was as if in finding the English language equivalents, you actually do create good writing. And I think that's mm-hmm. what I mean. It's as opposed to, say, there could be a really bad Solzhenitsyn translation, but I'm not sure if there could be a really bad Garcia Marquez translation.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I think in order to be a good translator, you have to, among other things, love the music of both languages so that you can re-render the music of the original in the language into which you are translating. Not copy it, not mimic it. A literal translation is not going to sing because it's not adapting itself to the inner music of the language that you are bringing it into.
How did you become a translator?
I became a translator in graduate school while I was working on my first novel. When I was revising it and realized I still had a lot to learn, I went back for an MFA at Mills College here in Oakland. And I took a class with Hannah Block, who's here from Brooklyn, amazing, incredible translator of poetry. And she really awakened me. I took the class almost on a lark. And that class really awakened me to the beauty of the translation process and what it does for my multilingual brain. I've always lived in the space between languages, and to get to do work that allows me to hover in the space between languages and fashion something out of it is actually exhilarating.
Have your 3 novels been translated into Spanish?
My first novel has been translated into Spanish and 15 other languages, incredibly. However, The Gods of Tango has not yet been translated into Spanish. And that's a source of great sadness for me because I have, first of all, so many relatives who helped me research it and talk about it and nourish the book so much, and they can't read it because they don't speak English.
Have you thought about translating it yourself?
You know, it's crossed my mind, but I don't really have the chops to translate English into Spanish. Because I was educated in English, English is, intellectually speaking, my stronger language. It's the language where I can take more syntactical risks and kind of be more acrobatic with language, let's say, whereas Spanish is the language of my bones. It's the deepest down, and yet I think it would be a stretch for me.
Well, also rewriting your own work.
It's kind of an interesting experience.
Well, it's sort of like turning a novel into a screenplay. I know a number of novelists who kind of go, I'll do a screenplay of someone else's work, but not mine.
Yes, I can understand that very much, because once you've really finished it and you've done so much to polish it, you've been through it so many times, it feels like done. It feels like the sphere has closed.
Speaking of Hollywood, has there been any interest in turning any of these three novels into either films or television series or anything?
There has been some interest and conversation, and the book is under representation. The books are under representation. However, there's nothing final.
In The Gods of Tango, you focus a lot on Buenos Aires. There's a little about Montevideo. What's that like? What's that city like?
I absolutely love Montevideo. I just spent a year and a half living there, and it's just an incredible hidden gem. It's a capital city of a tiny country, so Uruguay has 3.5 million people, and the big, big capital is 1 million people. When you put that in perspective with the size of cities here or other parts of the world, it's actually very small, so you can be in the big capital, have the amenities of that, be right around the corner from the presidential palace and the main museums and so forth, and also run into people that you know and have kind of a neighborhoody feeling. It's a very laid-back city for a capital. It's on the water, so you can walk the shore. The main pastimes of Montevideo are watching or playing soccer, drinking mate, and walking the Rambla or walking in the plaza. The Rambla is the shorefront promenade on the river, and the river is very large, so it looks like the sea. It looks like you're walking on the seaside. And to have that, to have the beach, you know, so close by, an urban beach, but one you can absolutely go to and swim at, for me, it's home. It's Oakland and Montevideo are my double home.
Is Uruguayan food different from Argentinian?
It's very similar. We also have the parrilla, which is the, you know, the barbecue, the famous, you know, the meat and all the different cuts of beef. Mm. We also do that. We do that very well. We also have the chimichurri sauce and the Italian influence. You know, as the Italian immigrants in this book show, I mean, at least half of Uruguayans and Argentinians are of Italian ancestry.
Really?
Absolutely. So one of the national foods of both countries is pasta, gnocchi. The 29th of every month is gnocchi day, and all the restaurants have gnocchi. Milanesas is very, very Italian food. The one thing that Uruguay has in its culinary offerings that Argentina doesn't is the chivito, which is like a thin-cut steak sandwich. And the chivito canadiense comes with egg and bacon and ham and cheese and all kinds of things in it. And when my Argentinian cousins came to visit me in Montevideo, I was very proud to serve them their first chivito.
Carolina de Robertis, now this book is out, Gods of Tango. What are you working on now?
I'm working on another novel, and it is set in Uruguay and kind of comes out of the gift of having lived there for a year and a half and gotten to steep in the place and bring research home.
How far into it are you?
I have 200 pages, but when the dust settles from this book tour, I'm going to have to really crack them open and see how many of them will actually stay around. I can't tell yet.
You've been listening to an interview with Carolina de Robertis, whose latest novel is The Gods of Tango. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.